We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Potterversity, a Potter Studies podcast. This is episode 13. Don't know much about arithmancy. Thanks for joining us at Potterversity. Today, Emily Strand and I will talk with Dr. Lana Whited about the more unusual features of the Hogwarts curriculum, with a special focus on arithmancy. I am Katie McDaniel, professor of history at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds Too.
And I am Emily Strand, instructor of comparative religions at Mount Carmel College and author of several Harry Potter essays.
Today we're going to talk about Hogwarts school subjects, and particularly arithmancy. Emily, were you a math whiz, arithmancy, like arithmetic? Were you big into the numbers game when you were in school?
No. Math was not my thing. It is, in fact, the only class in high school in which, and really, I think in my entire education, in which I actually got moved to the front of the room for poor behavior, for talkie-talkie in the back, because I did not like math. I did not want to be there. And then it was really funny because I must have had a pretty good teacher. And also, because I'm a musician, I think I understand math on some certain levels that, you know, maybe I wouldn't otherwise. Mm-hmm. And I ended up doing really well in math in high school, like so, well enough that I didn't have to take any in college. So I haven't even taken any math classes since high school.
Right. Yes. Yeah, so
should I admit that? Is that not...
Well, you know, but this, that I'm in the same boat, Emily. I'm actually pretty good at math, and I took AP calculus and shocked myself in getting, a viable score on that so that I didn't have to take it in college. And the first thing I did when I got to college was dropped calculus and picked up probably theater class. I'm pretty good at math, but I never really knew what I was doing. You know, I never really understood, why am I doing these things? And it's not until I began studying the history of science that I began to fully appreciate mathematics. You know, Galileo called it the language of the universe. The universe is speaking to us through mathematical formulas and relationships and so on. And so it's a way that we can understand the universe that we're a part of. And that really spoke to me. That's a kind of lyrical understanding of mathematics, that it means something now. And I just have a much bigger appreciation for that. And hopefully with our discussion of arithmancy, we'll actually, you know, get into a little of the history of numbers and, the way people used to think about numbers a little bit. And we're very pleased today to have joining us for this conversation, Dr. Lana Whited, professor of English and director of the Boone Honors Program at Ferrum College. She's the editor of The Ivory Tower and Harry Potter, with a second volume in progress called The Ivory Tower, Harry Potter, and Beyond. Lana was on our very first episode of Reading, Writing, Rolling, as we recorded from the Roanoke Harry Potter Festival, but this is Lana's first time on Potterversity. Welcome to the show, Lana.
Thank you. Hi, friends. I've really been looking forward to being with you today. Katie, and I don't think I've recorded a podcast with you since maybe June of the pandemic year. I think we talked about the Ichabod.
I think that's right.
On the other podcast. So it's been a while.
It has indeed. Yes. And so I'm so glad we're getting back together to talk a little bit about, I love the school elements of you know, Harry Potter and the Hogwarts experience and all of that. And so I'm glad to be able to focus on that a little bit.
Yeah, me too. Typically about this time of year, I am teaching middle schoolers in a program called Hogwarts Academy that's part of our summer enrichment group.
Yeah.
And that is organized around the Hogwarts core and elective subjects. And I've really missed doing that for the last couple of years.
Yeah. So, and I think that's the kind of thing where, you know, everybody goes to school. And so you can have that sense of, I don't know, are these subjects we'd like to learn ourselves? So let's talk about, first of all, what seems to be the basic goal of the Hogwarts curriculum? What's the reason that they require some classes and not others? What's the logic behind that curriculum?
Well, I think just as in the real world, students need certain core or basic information. In terms of a magical education, they need to know something about spells and about vocabulary of spells. They need to know how to make potions and how to deal with potions ingredients, which is where herbology comes in. They need to know how to deal with dangers, which is why they study defense against the dark arts, and what kinds of magic, I guess, should be avoided. The other thing that's a part of that core curriculum is astronomy. And that's kind of interesting to me because It seems to me that astronomy doesn't really become relevant in terms of the narrative line of the Harry Potter series until the third year in Prisoner of Azkaban, when students begin to take divination and they make star charts. That's certainly one of the ways that human beings have tried to kind of see the future over human history. But I think the answer to the question is just that there's certain basic or core information that students have to have.
Yeah. And I think, you know, even if you're not going to end up being good at potions, I don't really have this idea that Neville somehow became good at potions somewhere down the line. But even if you're not going to be good at it, you do need to know some basic information about it so that, you know, when you encounter a potion or when you need something, that you have an idea of what exists out there, like so many, you know, core educational subjects are trying to do. Not necessarily make experts, but just to give you a sense of what's out there.
I think that's true. And I think, you know, in the real world, there is a fair amount of math loathing. That's a very real phenomenon. Yeah. I see it with students, you know, when I help them make their schedules. In the world of Hogwarts, it does seem to be potions that draws those really strong reactions from students who either excel at it or really, really dread going to the dungeon. And of course, part of that is the personality of Severus Snape.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's a little bit different with Slughorn, I guess.
Yeah, it seems like more of a friendly atmosphere down there.
And he's more encouraging, I think, whereas Snape is more critical in his approach.
So let's talk about arithmancy. And just to acknowledge that I've heard it pronounced different ways. So I have always said arithmancy, and then recently my son said, no, it's rithmancy. And so, you know, we may have different pronunciations on the show today, but, you know, all are welcome, right? but what is it? Now that we're confused as to how to pronounce it, what is it? What is arithmancy actually? What's its significance in the books? What would you do in arithmancy class?
Well,
what do you think, Lana?
Let's start with etymology, since we've talked about pronunciation, and I certainly would not insist that there's a definite way to pronounce that word, but it does derive from the Greek roots arithmos, A-R-I-T-H-M-O-S, which means numbers. That's the same word, obviously, from which we get arithmetic. And the word mantia, M-A-N-T-E-I-A, that means divination. So, so literally, arithmancy is divination using numbers. And a practitioner of arithmancy is called an arithmancer. I have some trouble saying that word because I want to put another syllable in there. I want to say arithromancer for some reason. So I have to to think consciously about that.
What if you said arithmancer? Right?
Arithmancer. Maybe that would be easier. Yeah.
I don't know.
Otherwise, it sounds like eye ointment or something, you know.
Arithmancer.
So we're talking about a method of divination that uses numbers. And I wanted to be sure and make the point that this elective subject is another of those subjects that was not invented by Rowling for the Harry Potter series. It is an area of knowledge, or an area, it's a pursuit that has been used throughout human history. the ancient Greeks, for example, would assign values to the letters and the names of their combatants to foretell the outcome of their battles. And in the 9th century, the Chaldeans in Arabia, where our modern numbering system comes from, practiced a form of arithmetic in which they divided the alphabet into three parts, composed of seven letters at that point. And they attributed those to the seven known planets. I know we're going to spend some time today talking about the significance of the number seven, mm-hmm. Which obviously has a lot of magical properties and is a number that shows up in a lot of fantasy works. For example, there's seven volumes in the Harry Potter series. I asked students, middle schoolers in my summer class one time, to make a list of all the significances of the number seven in the series. And they wrote all over the board and needed more space and, you know, came up with so many examples.
Yeah, wow.
But essentially in arithmetic class, students would be using a method that generally is called reducing the individual digits in a number, a birth date, for example, to a single digit, or using this system of writing out all the letters in rows of, using the modern alphabet, we would write out the modern alphabet in rows of 9 letters each with 8 in the last row. So A, B, C, D, E, F, G, I, those would be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And then we would drop down and start a second line. The point is that every number in that system has a letter assigned to it. So we take the letters in a person's name and we assign those numbers and then we reduce it until we get a particular number. So if you take the name Hermione Granger, for example, and you add up all those numbers and then you reduce them, ultimately you end up with 4 when you've added all the numbers together and then you've added the digits in the numbers. And after that, you go to kind of conventional beliefs about the significance of numbers. And one thing that is true about the number 4 that I think a person might come up with, even if you just, you know, prompted with a question like, what do you associate with the number 4? We think of 4 as indicating a kind of solidity or kind of stability.
Yeah.
Tables have 4 legs, for example. And as long as those 4 legs are balanced, then the table is stable.
This, like a square, too, with the angles,
absolutely,
you know, 4 sides.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Which is another example of balance. So we make these correspondences between dates or names. We can take Harry Potter's birth date and we can reduce that and, you know, add 7 + 3 + 1 + 1 + 9 + 8 + 0, July 31st, 1980. Ultimately, we get the number 2 if we do that. And 2 is a number that I think all of us associate with interaction, two-way communication, for example, mm-hmm. the idea of cooperation. We also associate 2 with balance. And there are some properties of the number 2 that are kind of doubled in the number 4, since 4 is a multiple of 2. Mm-hmm. But this is essentially about kind of assigning properties or assigning significance to numbers based on an association of letters with numbers and based on these ideas of what numbers mean and what significance they have.
That's really cool. And, you know, I did go through a little phase at some point where I was doing a lot of numerology, which this sounds a lot like, where you would sort of find out your, like, your personality number, and it would tell you mm-hmm. a lot about yourself, you know, and sort of what your features were, your strengths, your weaknesses, and all of that, with the idea that somehow these numbers are kind of built in to the web of our existence.
There are different numbers that you calculate or using this reduction kind of process. And the one that you do with all the letters in your name, consonants and vowels, usually is called the character number. But you can also make these calculations using only the vowels in the name. And when you do that, the number that you arrive at is called the heart number. And then you can do it using only the consonants in your name. And the number that you arrive at is called the social number. And not surprisingly, and my middle schoolers in the summer class think this is really cool. Obviously, when you add together your heart number and your social number, you're going to get your character number because that's how it works. But they always have kind of a wow moment.
Yeah.
when they realize that.
Numbers are like that.
Yeah.
So I think the way that human beings have used this is to try to determine things like what dates are significant, what combinations of people might be workable or not workable, fortunate or not fortunate. And I think it really is true that all of us, even if we're not superstitious, I grew up in the Appalachian Mountains, and God knows there are plenty of superstitions there. But even if we're not superstitious, I think we do generally all agree that numbers have meaning, right? We give a lot of thought to picking mm-hmm. the date on which we're going to get married, the date on which a child is going to come into the world, if we have any control of that, like if you're having a C-section or an induction or something like that. My next door neighbor's son was born by C-section, and she picked the date 12/12 because she knew it would be easy to remember, you know, because it has that. It's like a mirror date. You know, so I think we do give that kind of thought to the significance of numbers. And that's really what arithmetic is all about.
Now, I hope it's not a problem that this is episode 13 now that we're now that we're talking about number significance.
I really like that.
No triskaidekaphobes in the crowd here, I hope.
Well, I think that's a terrific example of the way that we assign significance to numbers, because 13 is probably one of those that lots of people would assign specific meaning to. And there are tons of examples, you know, like hotels skipping a 13th floor in their numbering or that sort of thing. I read an interesting example on the internet last night, which had to do with the system of assigning license plates in Ireland, the Ireland Motor, or whatever that's called, the Irish motor industry, I think, that license plates were assigned so that the first two numbers indicated the year in which the car was registered. So you register a car in 2011, for example, and it would be 1-1 and then the rest of the number. The Irish motor industry decided not to use 1-3 as the first two numbers. Instead, they developed a kind of a different system whereby I think cars that were registered in the first half of that year were numbered 131 and in the second half of the year 132, but they didn't want to use that number 13 alone. So I think we do generally accept this premise that numbers have significance, that some of them are unlucky and some of them are lucky, or some are luckier than others. And that's kind of a fascinating aspect about human beings to me.
Yeah. And that right. idea that you can divine things and you can, you know, make predictions about the future. One of the things I think is so interesting, of course, we use numbers all the time to make predictions about the future, and we call it like statistics and science, actuarial science, right? So the insurance company is calculating, you know, when you're likely to bite the big one, right? One of the things that I tell my students, I teach the history of the scientific revolution. And when we're studying that, I try to impress upon them that numbers did not always carry the persuasive weight that they do for us today as a very kind of rationalist, mathematically, statistically oriented society. Mathematics was something that seemed really abstract to people, and that, you know, maybe you could play around with them, and numbers always seemed to work out in those funny ways that your students were sort of recognizing. But what do numbers really tell you? People didn't have much of a strong sense of that. But one of the things that I find so fascinating about that history is, as commerce grew more important in the European Renaissance, some people were getting very, very rich through this commerce, and they realized that that these numbers that had to do with prices and your inventories and all of that, that actually had a correlation to reality in a way that was very significant personally to them. And this is when the discipline of accounting was developed. Accounting develops in the Renaissance, and people start to see that numbers have a direct correlation with reality. They can tell you real things about relationships. And this is, you know, of course, how scientists became interested in, they're sort of looking at the heavenly bodies, and they're realizing that math is telling them something about the relationships between these bodies that they see orbiting around them in the heavens, like Copernicus. Of course, Galileo was a mathematician who, you know, had that idea about numbers being the language of the universe. And so the idea that numbers correlate to reality had to be brought into existence in a way that I think is sort of profoundly interesting, in the way that it is a kind of divination, right? It's, you know, trying to figure out the universe according to numbers. And whereas arithmancy might have a kind of a woo-woo factor, right? Sort of seems like it's, you know, it's magical. That's what numbers seemed like for much of the, you know, the history of Western humanity anyway.
I think it's important there that you mentioned the heavenly bodies, Katie, because my understanding is that that's where the sense of the number seven as having special significance really derives. I mean, as early as the time of Gilgamesh, seven was a number that was perceived to have special significance or supernatural properties. And I think that's because at the time it was believed that there were seven heavenly bodies.
Yeah. Absolutely. And, you know, Newton himself, inventor of calculus, so definitely a rational mathematical mind, he practiced alchemy, we know that, but also in his optics, he's the one who decided there were seven colors in the spectrum, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, right? The Roy G. Biv that everybody knows. But if you look at that, it's not like those are evenly, it's not like it's obvious that there should be seven, but he picked seven because seven has these divine properties. He thought the number was significant and that's the number of colors that we should assign to the spectrum.
Right. I mean, I probably don't need to point out the fact that there are seven sacraments in the Roman Catholic tradition. Mm.
Well, how about seven notes on a musical scale? I think Newton was thinking of that as well. You know, that there are all these ways that becomes this number that is expressive of, you know, something that maybe appears a little bit beyond the reach of mundane humanity.
Yeah, and so many good examples of that in the Harry Potter series, starting, of course, with the number of novels in the series. But Harry's Quidditch number, I think there's something like 700 fouls in Quidditch. There's seven players on a Quidditch team, seven children in the Weasley family. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are just so many of those. Seven Horcruxes. One of the ways that Rowling kind of marks Jenny Weasley's special significance is that she's the seventh child and she's a daughter. So she becomes kind of a twist on that idea of the seventh son of a seventh son, you know? So really important number. I think definitely the most important number in the Harry Potter series. And three is really important too. We can talk about that.
This is all helping me kind of process a couple questions I had kind of coming into this. So a few episodes ago, Katie and I had the good fortune to interview the Puffs creators, the off-Broadway Harry Potter-based play Puffs, which is excellent. So go listen to that episode if you haven't had a chance yet. But in the play Puffs, a very funny element of the play is the character Oliver, who as a muggle-born came into Hogwarts with a strong talent for math. He was kind of a math whiz. And yet he comes to Hogwarts and he experiences Hogwarts education and feels like his talents are not recognized or valued for math. And I think what we're talking about in terms of the tension between the modern, you know, notions of math that think of it as, you know, purely scientific and rational, don't really appreciate the ways in which it was, you know, as Lana said, part divination. You know, so that kind of helps, because I was always like, come on, Oliver, there's arithmancy, come on, you know, like, just be happy with that. But it really is quite different from modern muggle math. So it's helping me with that understanding. But what I don't understand is why Hermione loathes divination, yet seems to appreciate and like arithmancy.
I think I can give you a good answer for that question. I do want to say really quickly about Oliver. I think part of the problem may be this idea that because arithmancy is not a core subject, he can't study it until it's his third year at Hogwarts. Showing up at a school and really loving a subject like art, for example, and then finding out you don't study it till third grade. I think that would be a really disappointing experience. But for Hermione, who, you're absolutely right, loathes divination, has very little use for it, and sometimes makes fun of Professor Trelawney, and it's really not Hermione's style to make fun, I think, of a faculty member. But arithmancy is systematic in the way that logic is systematic. It's based on something substantive, numbers, obviously, as opposed to these other forms of divination that are highly subjective, that involve the interpretation of patterns or images. I'm thinking of things like tea leaf reading or crystal ball gazing. Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much individual interpretation. It's like the way that if you're playing with a Ouija board, you know, you can kind of move it in the direction that you really want it to go.
It's subjective.
Sure, very touchy-feely. But arithmancy is a more sciencey kind of approach to divination. So is the use of star charts. It's more systematic, based on methodology more science as opposed to art. I spent some time last night thinking about the notion of the arts and sciences and whether I think arithmetic is really more an art or more a science. And I decided that it is maybe the purest mix of the two among the Hogwarts subjects. So maybe
that's
Hermione
cool.
has contempt for divination because it's a subject that fundamentally can't be taught as well. I mean, it involves a gift. I was talking with Catherine Grimes about this yesterday, and she said, you know, you can put a person in an airplane and that person can fly in the airplane, but you can't make that person a bird. And I think that's a really good example, right? Because making a person a bird would involve transfiguration, actually. I guess you'd do that in transfiguration class.
Right.
The bird can't explain how it's able to fly any more than Sybil Trelawney is able to explain how she is able to discern a prophecy. I even thought about, when I was thinking about the word discern, I mean, what even is the right word? Is it figure out? Is it recognize? Maybe it's discern. I don't know. But in most versions of divination, the person who is the diviner is often characterized as entering into this mysterious or trance-like state in which that person may not be completely lucid or completely aware. Mm-hmm. Even of what's going on in their own head. So in that respect, divination has something in common with dreams, which of course is another way throughout human history that we sometimes have attempted to discern the future. Mm. The character of Joseph in the Old Testament is a great example. Mm-hmm. You know, how is he able to interpret the Pharaoh's dreams? He doesn't really know. He just knows that he can do it.
Because
it involves a gift, I think that makes it more difficult for Hermione because Hermione is all about hard work and studying.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah. And, you know, I sort of think about how she really scoffs at how is it Lavender who says, you know, Professor Trelawney said something horrible was going to happen this week. And I just found out that my rabbit died. And do you remember that? And that there's something actually about the way not the diviner, but the way the audience receives the divination that is a little squishy, you know? It's like you can then interpret, you can interpret that prophecy so that it fits the thing that you already know happened. And that seems like, you know, that seems like manure to Hermione, right?
Yes,
malarkey.
And easily manipulated.
Yes.
Right, for your own purposes.
Yeah.
It does seem like manure, but don't you think Lavender's response there, it comes out of our need to think that there's a reason why things happen. So maybe her rabbit died. Mm-hmm. Maybe Professor Trelawney is in connection with some force in the universe, you know, knows what kinds of things are going to happen. So maybe the death of Lavender's rabbit was even fated. And if she can believe that, I don't know, maybe it's a little easier for her to accept in the same way that it's easier for people to accept things. Maybe if they believe that God wanted this to happen or, you know, it's the need for explanation, I think.
Yeah. Everything happens for a reason. Philosophy.
Right.
Which I always have a big problem with.
Me too.
But,
yeah.
But it takes some of the randomness out of things that are a surprising shock, you know, that you can think, okay, as I process this, I'm processing it as a thing now that maybe was part of a larger story.
Right.
Yeah. So I definitely agree that there's a human quality to that. I definitely think astrology has to get a pickup anytime there's great uncertainty in the world. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
For something.
Think about Nancy Reagan having her husband's star charts done when he was involved in major world decisions. There's a great example of a person's, you know, obviously putting some stake in the idea of divination. I think this notion of people in the past, like leaders, for example, calculating the dates on which they should have battles and things like that, I think that also appeals to our need to feel like maybe we can have some control over what happens in life,
the notion
that maybe we have some control of human destiny. So I spent some time thinking about that too.
Yeah, well, and some of the astronomy is actually really important in certain world religions, like in Hinduism. You know, so you'll often have Hindu couples scheduling a C-section, you know, in order for the child to be born on a particular day that's auspicious, in terms of planetary alignment or whatever. So you know, this is stuff that still goes on today and that people do still appreciate today.
I don't know a lot about this, but I did read yesterday, and I think it was about the number. I don't remember what number it is. It may be 4, but there is a number that is sometimes avoided in Asian cultures simply because the way the word is pronounced is very similar to the pronunciation of the word death.
Oh, that's interesting.
You know, there are those kinds of ideas, too, that affect and influence people's sense of numbers and how numbers are used and choosing numbers. But I think part of it is that it gives us this illusion that there's something we can do to perhaps have some influence on our own destiny and the destinies of others.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit more about some of the numbers that Rowling uses significantly in the works that arithmancy might help us to actually kind of figure it out. And one of the numbers that you brought up, Lana, that I think is worth exploring a little bit more besides 7 is the number 3. What's the significance of that number and where do we see that through the Harry Potter series?
Well, we could pause here for Emily to talk about the Trinity, because that's certainly maybe the most important association, at least in Christian theology, mm-hmm. you know, with the number 3. But the Deathly Hallows is one of the best examples. The notion of the 3 elements of the Deathly Hallows. There are supposed to be 3 Triwizard Tournament champions, and then Harry's name gets thrown in. I think it's significant to remember that in the very first sentence of the Harry Potter series, Rowling uses a number. The Dursleys of number 4, Mr. and Mrs. Dursley of number 4 Privet Drive were happy to say they were perfectly normal. Thank you very much. You know, they live at number 4 Privet Drive. There's psychological theory about the significance of the number 3 having to do with the father-mother-child relationship. And if you think about it, you know, the Dursleys kind of followed that pattern, that triangular sort of pattern, until Harry comes along and he throws it off. So that's kind of one way to explain the disharmony that comes into the Dursleys' family when Harry comes along. Of course, you know, they have very much to do with that disharmony. But that's another example of that, the appearance of that psychological idea about the parent-parent-child relationship. I'm sure you guys can think of lots of other examples of the number 3 that are really significant. Lots of things happen in threes. That's a pretty common pattern in all of literature, not just in the Harry Potter series.
Well, and of course, we have the character triptych of Harry, Ron, and Hermione. That's so significant.
Absolutely. A lot of the things that John Granger, I think, would say about the turtleback structure of the Harry Potter series, any of the kind of echoes, the things that happen in book 1, book 4, and book 7, those would be examples of that 3 pattern repeating itself.
Oh, silence.
Lots of good stuff there. Lana, you also uncovered some interesting information about arithmancy that comes from the Wizards Unite game.
I want to begin by saying that I do not play the Wizards Unite game. However, I am interested in this figure who is mentioned in the Wizards Unite game, but not in the Harry Potter series, whose name is Bridget Wenlock, W-E-N-L-O-C-K. Please note that both those names, first and last, each has 7 letters. In the world of Wizards Unite, she's a 13th century arithmancer, and she is the person who is said in the wizarding universe to have discovered all the magical properties of the number 7. There is a story about her, which is that she wrote down all of her theorems in invisible ink, I guess, because she was afraid that they would be stolen. And there is something about arithmancy that kind of lends itself to puzzles and enigmas. It makes me think of, you know, codes in some mm-hmm. mystery and detective novels.
Yeah.
I believe one of the careers in the wizarding world for which you need a decent owl in arithmancy is code breaking. Bill Weasley, for example, is one character who is mentioned as having gotten a passing owl in arithmancy. But there's this story about Bridget Wenlock that when she came up with this theorem about the properties of the number 7, she wrote it down on the back of an envelope, and then she wanted to send a recipe to her cousin, and she unfortunately used that envelope, not remembering that she had written down in invisible ink this really important theorem. And then she had to figure out how to get it back without cluing her cousin into the fact that it had this important information on it. If you look at fan sites like Harry Potter Wikia about the Wizards United game, you'll see the detail that Winlock died in the year 1258. And if you use arithmetic to reduce that date, 1 plus 2 plus 8 plus 5, you get 16. And of course, 1 plus 6 equals 7. So I think that's just one more example of Rowling's cleverness and her absolute thoroughness about the detail in this world.
Yeah.
Also, I wanted to point out that another detail about Bridget Winlock. The story goes that against that stereotype of all the really smart people being sorted into Ravenclaw, which of course we know is not true because of Hermione, that Bridget Winlock was sorted into Hufflepuff. So maybe there's a little bit of consolation for Oliver there, Emily,
not right.
About,
yeah.
You know, this idea of having this really talented arithmancer sorted into Hufflepuff rather than Ravenclaw.
Well, Rowling loves puzzles so much, and she loves to like plant little games, I think, that we can decipher, not only with the naming that she does, but also with the number significance. And so I definitely think there's a lot to be found there with numbers in her books.
I think so too, and I've heard John Granger talk about Rowling's fondness for the game Minesweeper and her proficiency in recognizing patterns.
Oh, yeah.
And certainly recognizing patterns is relevant to what we're talking about with arithmetic as well.
So I'm thinking about the different school subjects that are important to particular characters in Harry Potter. So Hermione seems to really love ancient runes. And then, of course, it really comes in handy for her in book 7. Neville gravitates toward herbology. And we know he becomes a herbology professor. Lavender and Pavarti seem to like divination a lot. And Professor Trelawney. Lily was good at charms, right? Snape is the potions master, right? And of course, we know from book 6 that he was very good at potions as a young student as well. Let me throw this in there. Do we have a character, a main character or an important character whose specialty is arithmancy?
I would have to say no. I mean, Hermione really comes closest in the narrative.
Yeah.
But I really would have to say no there.
Yeah.
I think in those associations, though, Emily, Rowling does a lot toward using them to tell us important things about the character of that individual. You know, for me, the significance of the fact that Neville excels at herbology is his growth arc. That's absolutely appropriate, I think, for the character who experiences the most growth, probably.
Right.
In the Harry Potter series, the idea of something of being organic applied to Neville's trajectory through the series. I spent a fair amount of time in the last few days thinking about Lily and charms, because for me, some of the other associations you've just mentioned were a little more obvious. And I thought about the fact in everything I've read about charms and the distinction between charms and hexes and jinxes. I read over and over, first of all, that charms generally are perceived as having a more positive or helpful or at least non-hurtful effect. They're protective charms, for example. And certainly the idea of Lily's love for Harry serving as a kind of a protective charm is really important to her talent for that subject. Professor Flitwick says that Lily Evans was one of the most talented charms students he ever taught. But the other thing I read a lot is that a charm doesn't alter the substance of a thing. Wingardium Leviosa, for example, doesn't make a feather not a feather. It just makes the feather lift. And transfiguration is in most ways the opposite of that, because transfiguration does change the substance of a thing. So when you think about the combination of Lily and James, Lily is charms, James is transfiguration. I think a lot of the contrast in their characters can probably be explained in that dichotomy.
And how interesting to think about Harry as a combination of the two. He's got the protective, delicate charm work that preserves the essence of the thing, and he also has the power within for transfiguration, which is, I think, a core idea of the whole series. His arc is very much transfiguration, though his best subject is defense against the dark arts.
Right, right.
Right. Right.
And then didn't you say that his number, a significant number for Harry is 2?
From his birth date, yes. When you reduce his birth date, that's the number that you get. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's well, and I always think about Harry as a Christ figure. And of course, Christ has 2 natures, human and divine. And those kind of can correspond with his parents, if you think about it in certain ways, which I do. What about Draco? You know, I felt a little bad for Draco when I was writing about Draco's parenting by the Malfoys. I ran across some kind of disturbing comments, you know,
you
that
mean,
his father made
yeah.
About him in front of in Borgin and Burks, and saying, you know, well, Draco, if Draco's grades don't pick up, he's going to be, you know, fit for little else than crime, you know, or whatever. And he's this offhand comment about his son, who I think at that point, what year was that? Was that year 2? I mean, it just seemed really kind of. So and we know that Draco is actually an intelligent person. You know, he has some intellect. But what do we think Draco's best subject would be?
I generally think of him as good at potions, but that seems almost like it's Snape's favoritism somehow working there. And I'm not totally sure if that means he's good at it or not.
I think Draco comes across as really only good in areas where he has those sorts of advantages. I mean, in a sense, he doesn't really have to be good at any of those school subjects, because his father has so much influence and affluence that's going to open doors for Draco. The only thing he really seems in any way passionate about really is the dark arts, which is kind of off the table as an academic subject. You know, you
right.
can't study the dark arts. You can only study right. defense against the dark arts. Maybe the closest those students come to hearing anything about the dark arts is Mad-Eye Moody's lesson about the unforgivable curses. When they really do have something introduced into their curriculum that they're not supposed to emulate and not supposed to want to do. But I don't see Draco as really even remotely interested in any of those other subjects.
And I think too often the teacher affects whether a student's going to like a subject. You know, they don't really like magical creatures, care of magical creatures. But they like Hagrid, so they give it the good old try, you know, as they're trying to like it. But a lot of times I think they like the teacher, so they like the subject, and they don't like the teacher, like when Snape and potions, and they don't like the subject. Do we see that playing a role? Is that creating a kind of destiny for some of these characters and the things that they are, the things that they're studying in the curriculum?
I think Professor Binns is a good example, because he really ruins history of magic
yes.
for lots of students, you know?
Yes.
This idea that he just finally one day died while he was dozing in the staff room and went right on teaching. Partially, I think, because Professor Binns insists on focusing for the most part on the purely factual. And certainly as a historian, Katie, you know that human history is a whole lot more than just a collection of facts. It's not really until a dramatic event in the form of the opening of the Chamber of Secrets happens that the students really become interested in what Professor Binns knows about the Chamber of Secrets and its history as having been opened previously. And even then they have to beg him for that story. He doesn't just tell it to them. So I think that's a really good example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know, I think I find it kind of interesting as we look at the Hogwarts curriculum, they don't have a lot of subjects that are, you know, the kind of traditional subjects that we would take in school. Of course, this is one of Oliver's problems with it from the play Puffs. But history of magic is there. It's a history class. And as you said, we have astronomy is there. But I was sort of thinking about, you know, wouldn't it be useful to them to know literature? I mean, does it all have to be ancient runes? Wouldn't it be good for them to have some understanding of literature class? I guess it's not interesting for a magical school, but.
And we learned recently from Ian Desher that, you know, Shakespeare was definitely a wizard. So wouldn't they study his plays?
Sure. Well, you know, I do have, there is actually a discussion of why they don't do plays at Hogwarts in, I believe it's the Tales of Beedle the Bard, where they try to put on, this was many years ago, that students tried to put on a play version of The Fountain of Fair Fortune. that Beetle the Bard tale, and it was so disastrous in the things that actually happened, engorgement charms gone awry and things like that, that they just resolved they were never doing theater again at Hogwarts. It's like, we won't be doing that again. So there really is an funny explanation.
And, you know,
there.
I have to say, speaking of literature, a thing that I really love about the Harry Potter series is that when it becomes apparent in Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows that there is literature these students need to know about in the form of the tale of the three brothers, it's a folk tale. And I just love that because I really love folk tales.
And they are so, folk tales are such an ingrained part of the culture. They're sharing something really important to you that's coming from more than one mind, I guess, is sort of what I think about folk tales. It's from the whole community.
And this is a very kind of a Tolkienian element because, you know, in his very famous essay on fairy stories, he talks about how fantasy and the theater are sort of antithetical to each other because, like, you shouldn't be, and I may get this wrong, sorry, Tolkien people, you know, fantasy kind of challenges you beyond, and fairy tale, you know, challenges you beyond, you know, to push your imagination into things, you know, you can't see in the real world around you. And then theater tries to make that, you know, real and, you know, or at least, you know, believable. And that if you could make it real, it would be too frightful, you know, and so that's why he was always very opposed to, you know, theatrical representations of his own works and things like I often wonder what he would have thought of the films, and I just don't know, but yeah, it's kind of a to have that story from Tales of Beetle the Bard about how plays were just ruled out. That sounds like Tolkien creeping in.
Yeah, I'm sure. So are there any magical subjects that we find surprisingly absent from Hogwarts? And I'll tell you one that I was thinking about. And of course, it is being taught at Hogwarts, but just for, you know, the one short period of time. Why aren't they all learning occlumency, for example? This is a sort of made up field, occlumency. Although you should note that my spell check recognizes it. So I have a very sophisticated Potterian spell checker here. But occlumency seems very useful and like a basic kind of skill. I guess it's not basic, but something very important for people to be learning. Why aren't they learning that? And are there other magical subjects we feel like they should be getting?
I think occlumency seems like it would be particularly useful. For me, I think it's the healing arts. Where'd Madame Pomfrey train?
Oh, yeah.
And where did all those, the healers at St. Mungo's, you know, where did they do their training? What owls would a student need in order to prepare for training as a healer? I think that's really interesting, especially considering how much Rowling has said on the record about her mother's death from multiple sclerosis and its effect on the theme of parentlessness in the series. Mm. There's also really no attention to the subject of physical fitness. You know, there's Quidditch, but only a select group of students play it, and it's an extracurricular.
Right.
I don't know whether maybe that reflects a difference in the British and U.S. educational systems in terms of the presence of a physical fitness or a physical education, or even health, for that matter, class in the curriculum. But I think healing is just noticeably absent.
Yeah.
That's a great point. Definitely. I bet healing, it probably involves a lot of the other. I was trying to think, what does Madame Pomfrey do? There are potions, mm-hmm. right, that she's using. And also, we know the mandrakes. She has to know herbology.
There's some charms and some mm-hmm. transfiguration.
That's right. Yep.
Yeah. So it would be one of these, you know, interdisciplinary subjects where students could be bringing in things that they're learning from their other subjects that would have some practical application for sure.
You would just think, considering the popularity of health professions in the real world, that might at least get some mention, but it doesn't. So that, I think that's the most surprising to me.
Yeah, maybe they just need fewer healers in the wizarding community because healing is, it seems to be sort of so much more effective than, you know, modern Western medicine, you know, so kind of thoroughgoing and restorative, that maybe they just don't need as many professional healers, and so very few people go into it. So it's like the wizard grad school, you know, the You know, the fellowship after Hogwarts that you go to. But I was thinking more about occlumency. Honestly, I don't know. Like, if you want to teach that to just everybody, you know, because then you're blocking people from your mind. And maybe I'm getting a little Star Warsy in here, but I'm just like thinking about, like, you know, when people are having the dark thoughts or the, you know, and like, it's probably good for the adults around to be able to fish around in there occasionally if there's a problem, you know? I don't know. They just don't want to teach everybody to block their mind.
I think the whole concept of what legilimency and occlumency are is really fascinating. And it's interesting to think about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm definitely not in favor of teaching teenagers legilimency.
That seems dangerous.
Yeah, and I do understand your point there about occlumency, but I feel like, now come on, like my feeling as a member of a free society is that your thoughts ought to be your own. And I'm not into, you know, Cornelius Fudge deciding to rifle around in my thoughts or something because he's suspicious of me. You know, I guess I have a little bit of a, sort of gets my dander up a little bit thinking about that. Although, of course, it could be very useful for the good side. But are you the good side if you're using it a lot? I don't know.
These are good questions. I mean, you do have to think about, like, the Star Wars equivalent of the Jedi Temple and, like, all the adolescents in the Jedi Temple, you know, like, what's going on? They're all force connecting in their minds. Like, what? Like, yikes. You know, that seems like a liability, frankly.
It's a little too close.
Do you think there's something similar, Emily, going on in The Lord of the Rings with Frodo and what happens when he puts on the ring or when he has those moments when he feels like he's connecting maybe with Gollum or with Sauron or with... Do you think there's anything similar going on there?
Maybe connecting with Sauron. I don't know about Gollum. I think that they have sort of an understanding of each other, but I think it's basically just instinctual.
Yeah. I think that's true.
Yeah, and I guess possibly Gandalf could get in there. I don't know. I'd have to review that and see what kind of pointers there are to...
I guess the similarity to me seems like there are times when Frodo can put on the ring or take off the ring, and that affects what Sauron can know and the ways in which he can respond by sending out the Black Riders, for example. Mm-hmm. I don't know. Maybe there's a parallel there. I'm not really enough of a Tolkien scholar maybe to develop that.
There's certainly a parallel with what happens between Harry and Voldemort.
Right.
So I think that's an important connection there.
Right.
Now, Emily, you and I saw at the Southwest Popular and American Culture Conference, SWPACA, we saw a presentation about sort of why there's no technology in the wizarding world. And I sort of was interested in, of course, there is a lot of, like, there are a lot of little magical devices, the Deluminator and the Pensieve, and I'm sort of interested in, you know, why isn't there like a magical tech class that would be about, you know, magical engineering or something like that?
Yeah, magical tools and devices.
Ooh.
Yeah.
That would be cool.
That sounds fun.
For the hands-on learners.
That's right.
I don't know. All of the wizarding education seems very hands-on. So...
Well, that's
and
true.
Speaking of hands-on, when I teach arithmetic in the summer class that I referred to before, I always insist to those students that they not just get out a calculator and add up these numbers. I always insist they do it with a pencil and a piece of paper and do the adding by hand. And sometimes they miss add, and I always check their calculations. But I want to kind of simulate that sense of technology being absent when we do that.
Ooh, yeah. And, you know, I was thinking, too, about this idea of application, because Rowling definitely privileges that kind of education. And you can see that especially in the way that she depicts the history of magic class. But also when Umbridge comes in and only wants to teach them theories about defense against the dark arts and not, you know, not have it be demonstrated. And we always think of Lupin as being a very good teacher because he is so, you know, he is actually having them put things into practice. And, you know, and I think that maybe when we look at the Hogwarts curriculum, we see a lot of experiential learning in the language of today, you know, where people are actually, the students are having to put things into practice, because so much of the magical arts do have to do with these you know, these skills that in some ways are not only mental, but physical.
Yeah, if you can blow yourself up or singe your hair in the course of a lesson, that's pretty hands-on, I think. Or turn yourself into a, you know, whatever you might turn yourself into in transfiguration class.
Yeah. Banish one of your eyebrows.
Right.
I wanted to ask the two of you, I sent you a little arithmancy exercise last week, and I was interested in knowing if either of you worked out your character number.
I didn't do my homework, but I can do it now. It's
Do your homework.
Now, yeah. Is it your whole summer. Name? Is it first, middle, and last name?
Generally, with the examples I've seen, it's just first and last name. So okay. You just like add all those numbers together. And while you're doing that, I'm just going to mention, if it's okay, some examples from the Harry Potter series that I think we can pretty easily kind of see in terms of the significance of the number. For example, if you assign the numbers to letters and reduce the numbers for Albus Dumbledore, you get one.
Ooh.
Of course, because God.
Yes, because God. And because Dumbledore is such a loner.
Yeah.
You know, so withdrawn from Harry. I believe that's also
like
true
God.
Of Voldemort, that you get one.
Oh.
If you reduce the name. Mm. Severus Snape is also a two. How great is that?
Yeah, it is great.
When we think about this idea of being kind of, you know, between the dark side and the good side, I mean, that's kind of a classic illustration of everything that I think we think the number two is representing. Sirius Black and James Potter are both sevens, and we've said a lot about the significance of the number seven.
Golden boys.
Arthur and Molly Weasley are both fives.
Huh.
And I think maybe the most significant thing about that is that they both have the same character number. I mean, that might be more significant uh-huh. than anything mm-hmm. we associate with the number five, because it's not quite a number that we have the kind of clear associations with that we have with three or seven or one or mm-hmm. Or four. Here's another one I like, because there's several sets of twins, is looking at Fred and George Weasley, who really get along and work together than lots of other sets of twins. That I have known, almost as if they complete each other. If you calculate their character numbers, Fred turns out to be a six, George comes out to be a three. And generally, the number six is a number that's associated with harmony. We've talked a lot about three. The number three is often associated with completeness, the idea of the complete Deathly Hallows or the complete Trinity, for example, the idea of becoming one, maybe. In addition, both of those add up to nine, which in numerology generally signifies completion to the fullest degree. So, you know, there's something about the alignment of those numbers that kind of signifies, I guess is a good word, the combination or the synergy that is produced by the combination of Fred and George. Incidentally, if you type the entire alphabet into an arithmetic calculator, and there are some of those online, or if you add up all the numbers in the alphabet and you reduce that, you get nine. And that's just one example, I think, of why arithmetic is so appealing to Hermione, because they're all these cool kinds of results mm-hmm. from the calculations.
Yeah, that's
I
neat.
Love it.
And now this week's special segment, homework in the Potterversity common room. Emily and I have been doing our arithmancy homework provided by Dr. Whited. And we've been working out our various numbers.
Oof, we're crunching the numbers.
Crunching the numbers. Definitely, I got my pencil. I was doing a lot of adding. It's pretty basic math. Not that complicated.
Yeah, it's just repetitive.
Yeah. So,
depending on how long your name is, I guess.
Yeah. So, friends, if you are in a place where you can get to the numerology chart, it is the Pythagorean chart that we're using. Pythagoras did all kinds of things with numbers.
Yeah.
We have lots to thank Pythagoras for.
Yeah.
So you can actually look at this chart and listeners, you can do your number too. Find out your vibrational number using your birth date. And you use all the numbers in your birth date. And that includes Like, you can't just use the last two numbers of the year. You gotta use all four of the year. And then we did character or personality number, mm-hmm. which uses the name. And then within that, the heart number, which is the vowels in your name, and the social or life number, which is the consonants in your name. And so we have a whole bunch of numbers representing us here. So, Emily, how did yours come out? How did you find this process?
Well, so there's a lot of numbers here, and I'm going to admit, Katie, I'm not positive what to do with all of them, but my vibrational number was 9.
Okay.
What does that mean? What does that tell me?
I don't know. Okay, but Dr. Whited gave us some references. We've got to. I was just telling my students, you got to be resourceful. And so we have looked it up on a website called Hogwarts Is Here. And we have the meaning of the numbers spelled out for us. And let's look, what's number 9? And that's your vibrational number. And the vibrational number, it is the destiny or life path number, or it could be your lucky number. Lucky number 9?
It hadn't been until now, I guess.
Okay. All right. Okay, here's what it says. 9 represents completion and achievement to the utmost. Hey, yeah. That's good, Emily.
Oh, that's right. Okay, that's this. This is kind of like an overall number.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I have this. Yeah. This. I thought this was good. This. Mm-hmm. This was good for me.
Yeah, I think that Dr. Whited also was saying 9 is the best number because it's what all of the alphabet adds up to. All of the letters in the alphabet add up to 9.
Yeah, I thought this part about it says 9s dedicate themselves to service mostly as teachers, scientists, and humanitarians. Okay, I'd like to think I'm a humanitarian and
yes,
a teacher.
Very you.
Not I teach scientists, I teach nurses. So determined, they work tirelessly and are an inspiration to others, but they can be arrogant and conceited when things don't go their way. Hey, you know what? I can be arrogant and conceited. I'm more arrogant and conceited when things do go my way. When things don't go my way, then I get a little humble.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
You know, whatever. The rest of it was, I liked it.
Right.
I was
right.
Okay with being a 9.
That's good. Okay, but listen to mine. Like, I got all right. 5s all over my arithmancy chart. I have lots of 5s, and the 5 is not that great, even though I actually even looked at a different site because I was like, I don't like the way this sounds. So I thought maybe a description somewhere else would be good. And it says 5 is the pivotal number because it's midway in between, but it's still not that great. Okay. Here's what it says. 5 is instability and imbalance. Change and uncertainty. 5s are drawn to many things and commit to none. They are adventurous, energetic, willing to take risks, and they enjoy travel and meeting new people, but are unwilling to stay in one place. 5s can be conceited, quick-tempered, and impatient.
Yeah, that's less flattering.
Yes.
I mean, there's some good stuff in there.
Yeah,
adventurous, energetic, willing to take risks.
Somebody had a bad experience with a 5.
Yeah, right? Somebody did. Somebody did. Yeah, I don't know. I think there are parts of that, you know, suit you. All the good parts. All the good parts suit you, Katie, and all the bad parts don't.
I'll take that. No, but I don't know. I'm not that much of a risk taker. I'm quite cautious and unwilling to stay in one place. Like, staying in one place it's got to be one of my favorite things to do. Like, sit on the couch. Love it.
An advantage in a global pandemic.
Yes. Now, it did get to be a bit much, but you know, my husband, he's a go-getter. He likes to go, you know, get out and, you know, be about, and he has to get out of the house. But I could spend the whole weekend in the house, never leave.
Yeah. I always say that's hobbitish behavior.
Oh, okay.
This 5 sounds like a hobbit, to be honest, except maybe for the quick-tempered, impatient stuff.
Yeah. But no, they say you're unwilling to stay in one place.
Okay. Never mind. Strike that one.
Yeah. So
strike
I was
that from the
feeling
record.
Maybe I'm not living my destiny. Okay. All right. But 5 is also, 5 is my character or personality number too.
It was just supposed to be a segment, but it changed my life.
Oh, this homework is killing us. So what is your character number?
Okay, my character personality number is 51.
And then you
that was the one together. I didn't know what to do with. I was like, okay.
You like add the five and the one.
I add the five and the one. And so then it's, oh. So it's six.
Yeah.
So then what do I do with that? Do I refer it to the list?
Okay. So, yeah. So listeners, you always got to get to a one digit number. So if you got two digits, you got to add them together until you get the one digit number. And so the vibration number is your birth date, but the character number is your first and last name and like all the letters in it. And so you're six.
So I'm a six.
Good one. This is a good one.
So it's this, and it's the same explanations of the numbers at that are at Hogwarts is here.
Yeah.
Okay. Guys, here. This is not just homework. This is the homework help session.
Right.
Because Katie's helping me with my homework. Okay, let's see. Harmony, friendship, and family life. Harmony, that's good for me. I'm a musician. Sixes are loyal, reliable, and loving. This sounds more like my husband. They are good at teaching and art, but are often unsuccessful in business. Oh, that's me to a T. They're sometimes gossips and prone to complacency.
Yeah, that's a pretty positive one, though, I have to say.
Yeah.
I'll take that over quick-tempered and conceited.
Never stays in one place.
I don't agree with that at all.
I know.
I'm throwing this homework away.
I don't.
I was trying to be quick-tempered there, but it took me a while. Like, it obviously took me 5 minutes to think to get to quick-tempered.
To rage at it, yeah. I don't think so, Katie.
Yeah. So guess
what about
what,
you? What was your character number?
It was a five. And
again?
And guess what my heart number is?
A five?
It's a five.
Oh my gosh.
So does somebody else besides Pythagoras have a number system? I think they might. There might be an alternate scale here.
Yeah.
Yeah. What about you? Have you got now, right? The heart number is only the vowels.
Okay. Only the vowels. So I did it wrong again where I didn't reduce it to the number, but it'll be six again.
Oh,
so the heart number is six again. Okay. And then let's see, the life number was consonants only, so that'll be a nine. So I've got all sixes and nines.
Yeah, my social and life number is also nine. So that was the only one that wasn't a five. And that's the completion number. That's pretty good.
So that's the one how do you like interface with the world?
Yeah.
Well, then what are the others for?
Well, the heart, the number is like your inner truth. And then your character number must, I don't know, it's the combination. So, hey, Emily, did you do the extra credit where you see if your partner's number is compatible with yours? The idea is if it adds up to nine, you're compatible.
Oh, you know what? I'm not sure that's going to be a healthy exercise. I think we're just going to leave that one alone over here.
Yeah.
But tell me, did you do it?
I did it. We're not a nine.
Oh.
we're a four. But all I know is that a nine is good. So I'm going to assume a four. A four is probably pretty good too, right?
Yeah. I like fours. Four's square. You know, there's an earthiness to four.
That's right. That's stability.
Yeah. McGonagall's glasses.
Stability. Yeah. And what does it say about four in general here? Fours are stable. See, that's what we said.
Yeah.
Enjoy hard work, practical, reliable, logical. I don't love that for description of my relationship with my partner.
Practical, reliable, and logical. But like one of you is Vulcan.
There's some real solids to this. So I'm going to take a four as good.
You're organized and good at getting things done.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would say you guys function very well.
Yeah, and we just won't look at the suspicious and prone to angry outbursts. That's not right.
We'll gloss right over that.
No. All right, well, listeners, I hope you all get a chance to play around with your arithmancy homework, and we will try to make that the little worksheet available to you so you can do it yourself and check out what your number is.
Yeah, check out the show notes.
Yeah. And, you know, I do think there's some sort of fascinating mystery surrounding numbers and the way that we interact with numbers. And everybody's got like a lucky number. And you know, you, numbers that you you find inauspicious, right?
Yeah.
And so, right. You know, I think it's interesting to think about what our numbers might be. But obviously, I'm hoping that I'm not so thoroughly a five as this.
Nah. And even if you were, we'd still love you.
Yeah. All right. So back to class, Emily.
All right. Homework complete.
Homework complete.
Yeah, so what did you guys come up with?
My name boiled down to a five.
You're a Weasley.
Oh, right. That's right.
Yeah.
One thing I've read about the number five, Katie, is that it is associated with people who are adventurous, who are willing to take risks.
Ooh.
So fives generally, I think, enjoy travel. They like meeting new people. You know, for each of these qualities, I guess there's a kind of a more positive side and a more negative side that might translate into restlessness or not staying in one place very long. Mm. But it also might travel, might translate into gregariousness or just, you know, the idea of lots of kinds of experiences.
I think that we could share the arithmancy exercise that Lana sent to us in our show notes and make those available to our listeners.
That would be fun. Very cool.
It is fun. It's a lot of fun.
Well, with that, that brings us to the end of our episode today. Thank you, Dr. Lana Whited, for being on the show.
My pleasure. It's always a blast.
How fun to be able to talk, you know, Hogwarts school stuff. I just enjoy that. And I'm going to let Hermione have the last word on this one. If being good at divination means I have to pretend to see death omens in a lump of tea leaves, I'm not sure I'll be studying it much longer. That lesson was absolute rubbish compared with my arithmancy class.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes. And be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsburn, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsburn. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time, class dismissed.